From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Mars fever is on the rise again, with government agencies and private space entrepreneurs all raring to go there, either vicariously through exploring spacecraft or in person. This hour, our own astronomy crew is back with an update on all the Mars activity. Also, tons of excitement this week over the news of icy plumes spurting out from one of Jupiter's moons, Europa. Today in The Exchange, we're skygazing with three Granite State astronomers, and let's hear from you. First, your questions and comments about Mars missions and Mars travel. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Now, the members of our Sky crew include Mal Cameron, former astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepard Discovery Center. And Mal, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Also with us, John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England, director of the UNH Observatory, and an astronomy instructor at UNH. John, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Laura.
Also with us, Nicole Gallucci, assistant professor of physics and astronomy at St. Anselm College. And Nicole, welcome back to you, too. Good to
Thanks.
See you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So let's all start with the latest news before we jump in on Mars. And there's always a lot to talk about with Mars. The latest news, lots of excitement just this morning about what are called icy plumes on Jupiter's moon, Europa. John, so we've talked about water on Europa for a long time. So what's new with this?
Well, it's interesting that the new rush of information coming out about Europa is really old data from the Galileo spacecraft, which was launched in the late 1980s, got to Jupiter 95, and it was crashed into Jupiter's atmosphere in September of 2003, so that the spacecraft wouldn't inadvertently crash on moons of Jupiter that could be habitable. Of course, we didn't know as much when Galileo met its demise at Jupiter that we do now, but the results and the data that Galileo collected in its 8 years at Jupiter gave tantalizing hints that of a liquid water ocean that contains about twice the volume of Earth's oceans of liquid water.
Wow, that's a lot of water.
It's a lot of water, and we're finding that the large moons of the big planets are mainly water ice. Yeah, there's some dirt and some rocks, but there's a lot of water ice. So the plumes, kind of under pressure, are gushing water, very, very small amounts, but that was seen through the Hubble by the Hubble Space Telescope as just hints of water plumes coming from these deep subsurface oceans. And of course, on Earth, wherever we find water, we find life. Now, we all know that Europa isn't Earth. But the funny thing about Europa is the water beneath the crust, icy crust, is salty water, so it has a lower freezing point. And there's a lot of internal heat mechanisms to generate heat that can keep this water liquid.
Well, it would have to be internal, right? Because it's pretty far from the sun, so
exactly.
It's not going to get surface heat.
But the thing that's keeping this water liquid is called tidal heating. It's the moon itself is being kneaded like making bread. It's actually pulled, twisted, and contorted by the gravity from Jupiter and its nearby neighboring sister moons. So because of the shape of Europa's orbit around Jupiter, it inflicts a different gravitational pull as Europa orbits Jupiter in this elliptical orbit. Sometimes it's closer to Jupiter, sometimes further away. And this generates, if you put a 1 and 13 zeros after it, that's how many watts of thermal energy this kind of tidal heating can introduce inside of Europa. And that's what we think is keeping that water liquid. And it's just, some of it's just popping out in around the equator
so
of Jupiter.
So it's too bad we can't like hook a line up to that and send it to Earth, because that would solve probably all of our energy woes. I mean, that's huge. It's amazing.
Well, it means that now there's two satellites orbiting gas giant planets, Enceladus at Saturn and Europa at Jupiter, that are giving away free samples of subsurface oceans. So all we have to do is fly through them with the properly equipped satellite.
Well, one of the other cool things about this story, in addition to all the sort of wow factors that you mentioned, John, is, as you said, that some of this discovery just this week comes from data that was trickling in for decades. And I want to play just a little clip from the NPR piece this morning from Xin Zhuozhua. He's a researcher who worked with Galileo data in his graduate work, so a while back. He was at a conference last year when he realized the old Galileo data might still be relevant.
That's the moment where we realized that we might have something in the old Galileo data that we never really paid much attention to. When we look at those data carefully, what we found is there are some strange magnetic signals in those data that have never been explained before.
So don't throw out your notes, I guess, is the lesson. What do you think, Mal?
Yeah, just a couple of things. When John was talking about the statistics of Europa, you have to keep in mind that Europa itself is roughly the size of our moon. And yet it has more water under the surface than we have on the surface of Earth.
So that makes it even more amazing. It's deep, deep, deep.
Right. And the other part of that, and the way they saw that, by the way, is because it's a very icy world. And there are these chunks of ice that they observed during the Galileo mission that actually had been shifting and rotating around. And the only way for that to happen was if there were a liquid underneath it to allow that to turn. It wasn't frozen solid all the way through. And the other part of that, and maybe even Nicole can jump in on this one, is that this latest discovery was discovered through readings of the magnetometer on board. And I don't understand all of that, but... anybody else get in on that?
Well, what's cool, again, is, you know, all this old old equipment, old data. You know, we like to think that what we have now is the latest and best and greatest, but it just shows that some of this older equipment was pretty darn useful, too, and giving us some very good information, as we heard in that clip.
But a magnetometer picks up magnetic fields and stuff, and this is what they were picking up at this little anomaly that they weren't sure what it was, but they zeroed in on these plumes and said that's where it was picked up from, and that gave them the clue that this is probably liquid water.
Well, from Europa to Mars. And I want to remind our listeners that they can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can always send us questions on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. So let's talk about Mars. And Nicole, to you first. InSight, lots of activity, lots of people sending all sorts of rovers and hoverers and who knows what to Mars. No people or animals yet. But what about InSight? NASA just launched this pretty recently.
Yeah, so I'm actually a little bit sad I missed this launch. I try and watch all the live stream launches of cool things, but I was so into finals and grading that I just
understandable.
I missed it, sadly. But yeah, so Mars InSight is a great mission, which is going to be looking at the interior of Mars. We've spent a lot of time crawling over the surface of Mars with rovers, digging with scoops. But what they're going to do with InSight, and they've got this really... kind of cute description at NASA where they're taking Mars's vitals. They're taking its temperature, they're taking its pulse, and they're checking its reflexes. So that means they've got a bunch of instruments that are looking at things like Mars quakes. So a Mars quake is like an earthquake, but on Mars, the ground shakes. But Mars doesn't have plate tectonics like we do. We have these interlocking plates on our surface, and the movement between them creates earthquakes. But there are other things that could cause quakes on Mars, other say deformation or changing of the crust and the layers just underneath it. So they can use those Mars quakes, map how they travel through the interior of Mars, and tell us more about Mars's interior. We know a lot about Earth's interior by tracking earthquakes and how they move through the Earth's interior. We don't know this about really the other terrestrial worlds. So we're going to be tracking seismic waves on Mars. They're going to be sending a temperature probe down. I forget how deep down that's going, something like 16 feet, to look at the temperature, how the temperature changes as you go underground. And they're also have a little radio beacon on the lander itself, which they're going to use to very, very precisely track Mars's wobble of its rotation. So again, that's something we know really well for Earth. We know how the Earth wobbles just so, which again tells us about the interior. If you've ever tried to spin an egg on a table, if you spin a raw egg and you spin a hard-boiled egg, you'll notice they spin very differently based on what's inside. So we can use that little wobble of the spin to tell us what's going on there.
Wow, that's a great analogy. And it is kind of fun the way they're explaining the significance of this mission. As you said, Nicole, InSight will take Mars's vital signs, give Mars its first thorough checkup since the planet was formed 4.5 billion years ago. So, John, sounds like time for a checkup, 4.5 billion years. But as Nicole said, you know, we have had a lot of rovers and explorers crawling over Mars. So why is this so significant?
Well, as Nicole said, it's the first time we're going to look beneath the surface. And we know that Mars, being a smaller rocky planet, its interior cooled more quickly than the Earth's or Venus has. We know that Earth is geologically active. We have volcanoes erupting on Hawaii like crazy right now. We know that Venus is volcanically active. Mars, not so much. We're not saying that it's absolutely dead geologically, but Mars InSight will help us determine just how active or inactive it is. And because Mars cooled, because its interior, its molten interior cooled, it lost its magnetic field. And without a magnetic field, it leaves a planet's atmosphere susceptible to be blown away, eroded away by the sun's solar wind. So Mars has a very, very thin atmosphere, about 1% as thick as the Earth's atmosphere, primarily because it lost its magnetic field when its interior cooled.
Now, that's really interesting. Sorry to interrupt you, John. So life on Mars, you know, with all the dangers that we've talked about on this program before, and we'll talk about again, but that's a danger that I had not thought about before. The fact that its interior cooled means its whole atmosphere could just be, you know, scratched away by solar wind?
Yeah, there's two. There's a Mars orbital mission from India, and there's MAVEN, a NASA mission, there to study the atmosphere of Mars and watching. They can see it being swept away to this very day. And that's only because it has no magnetic field to protect it from charged particles coming from the sun. So when you hear of a volcano erupting on Earth or there's an earthquake, be thankful that our planet has an active internal geology, because that's part of the reason that we have a pretty strong magnetic field, and it deflects the solar wind around the Earth's atmosphere, so it's not exposed to this erosion effect of the charged particles blowing out of the sun at 400 kilometers per second.
Well, that's amazing and particularly relevant since we're seeing those volcanoes on Hawaii right now. So yeah. Be thankful for that interaction between that active core of the Earth protecting us on the outside. That's amazing. You learn something new every day. So, Mao, why do you think that this particular mission, again, we've had a lot of missions to Mars, why do you think this is important?
I think a lot of that's been covered, but it is important to learn more about the inside, because we know, as Nicole was saying, we know a lot about the Earth. We know a lot about the innards of even some of the gas planets with the probes that have been out there. So by learning more about all the other planets around, I suppose the next step would be to go to Venus and try the same thing, but that's a little more difficult.
Yeah, because it's so hot there, your probe might just burn up, right?
We know a lot about one of the interesting things, if I can diverge just a little bit, I was thinking about Mars. Mars is not as large as the Earth. It's about half the diameter of Earth. And because of that, there are some unusual things going on. And I'm just reminded of a talk I went to by a NASA scientist a few years ago. And he was talking about the volcanoes on Mars. And the largest volcano in the solar system is Olympus Mons, which is taller than Mount Everest here on Earth. But it's a flat pancake-type volcano that spread out enough so that the entire mountain could fit over the state of Arizona. But he said, if you want to be a mountain climber and you want to go to Mars and climb this mountain, it would be a really weird experience because, first of all, it would be just like having a stroll across a flat plain because it's such a gradual climb to get to the top. But when you start the climb, because of Mars being smaller, you would not be able to see the top of the mountain as you're starting. You have to wait till you go over the edge of the horizon in order to see your goal.
Well, speaking of seeing Mars, there's a couple plans for exterior exploration as well. Even though there's been a lot, there's always more. I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. exchange@nhpr.org is our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Send us your questions or comments about Mars exploration, both spacecraft and human. Again, exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So speaking of the surface, still a lot to look at there. And Nicole, in 2020, NASA plans to launch a small 4-pound helicopter over Mars. It looks kind of like a drone that you see at, you know, a football game or something, about the size of a softball. So what's that going to do? What's the purpose?
So that's going along with the Mars 2020 rover. And the Mars 2020, mission will be doing some surface geology on Mars. But they're also testing a concept for this helicopter. This would be the first heavier-than-air vehicle to be flown over an extraterrestrial surface. So you've got 1% of the atmosphere that we do on Earth, but that they think is enough to test out a helicopter. So I think it's about football size and weight of a football that they would be doing some engineering tests to see how plausible that is, because you can one of the things that slows the rovers down, you have to take a picture and see where the rocks are, and then slowly drive around the rocks, remembering that there's a light travel time from Mars that can be several minutes. So it takes a while to carefully drive around the surface. You might have a little bit more freedom if you're able to fly above those rocks.
So you can take better pictures from up there. But you mentioned the atmosphere, and I do wonder what sorts of adjustments they had to make, Nicole, to get something to fly in that atmosphere. You know, here we put a drone up and it flies and it's fine, but we forget that it's partly thanks to our atmosphere.
Yeah. So they have to design that carefully to work in an environment with so little atmosphere.
What about the dust, John? If I were designing something to go on Mars, I would worry about the dust gumming up my works.
And they're definitely worried about dust. It's a hugely abrasive material that constantly gets blown by the wind, blown up into the sky. And that could be very damaging to moving parts. So you can imagine sand getting in, you know, wheel bearings. So Martian dust, which is even more abrasive than the dust we have on Earth, could really be detrimental to any kind of moving parts on a flying rover, if you will, this helicopter. But I think the interesting thing about this mission is there are a number of deep caves on Mars that are, some of them, as large as 800 feet across. And when their photographs were taken by spacecraft orbiting Mars, like the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, we looked down into these 800-foot-across holes in the surface. We don't know how deep they go. And my hope is they send these drones, these helicopters, into these caves and measure the atmospheric pressure as it goes below the surface. Well, who knows? If they go 5 or 6 kilometers below the surface, maybe there's enough air pressure to keep water liquid.
Maybe that's where the little green men live, is in the caves.
That's right.
And we just haven't seen them yet.
And I'm glad you mentioned that. We know, because men are from Mars.
Well, actually, that's a perfect segue to what we're going to talk about next. A little discussion about whether the first man on Mars should be a woman. So we'll talk about that after a short break. Stay with us.
Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight? Now, people come here to see the alpacas. Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, our astronomy crew is back, and we're covering lots of stories, including icy plumes on Jupiter's moon Europa, lots of Mars explorations, and a little bit later we'll hear about a planet that could be, as one scientist put it, a biosphere. You know what that means. You can join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that email, exchange@nhpr.org. So all of you, just to wrap up our Mars conversation, because there is a ton more to talk about. A recent BBC piece speculated about whether the first person on Mars should be a man or a woman, mentioning that it's only been men on the moon. So why not give the honor of the first person on Mars to a woman? And Nicole, are you up for it?
Personally? Yeah, let's go. Actually, if I'd have to leave my dog behind, then no. That would make me sad.
Well, didn't the Russians used to send, like, monkeys and dogs in space? You could probably bring your dog.
They didn't always come back.
They had very bad karma with that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so this is a really interesting piece on deciding who's going to be the first person to step on Mars. I'm a little sad about that because when I was a kid in school, everyone was saying, oh, you could be the first person on Mars one day. And, you know, it's how many years later and we're still not even close. But I'm still hoping to see that in my lifetime. And it's an interesting discussion that intersects with a lot of things happening both in the science fields and in engineering fields and in society at large, is the places of women in the workplace and the visibility of women in the workplace. One way in which this has come about within spaceflight is there's been a large push to move away from using the term manned spaceflight and using piloted spacecraft or crewed spacecraft, although crewed is a little bit odd, C-R-E-W-E-D. And that's something that a lot of us have been working to change when we talk about it, because, yes, the space flight that we're talking about, this future includes humans of all genders. You know, it's not just a singular mission. And I'm encouraged by this story, the thought that they would send a woman out to the surface. And partly because it does do a good job of highlighting some of the women at NASA who are working on these missions. The numbers of women in STEM fields, so science, technology, engineering, mathematics, are still low, particularly in engineering and mathematics, computer science. My own field of astronomy, it's a bit higher, but having more women there doesn't erase all the problems of sexism. There's a lot of talk around the Me Too movement. Astronomy had its own high-profile sexual harassment cases come out before that, and so we kind of got
left
behind.
Not a new topic.
Yeah, no, it's not a new topic. So as much as I'd love to see, this talk of having, you know, women take that first historic step, I also want to make sure we turn that around and talk about how women are treated in the workplace, in STEM fields and everywhere.
Well, and whenever I prepare for this show, I spend a lot of time, you know, watching space videos and NASA explainers and all that stuff. And I do see, Nicole, at least an effort to represent women more and more and more.
Sure. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, and NASA had a conversation with one of their female astronauts who spent 6 months on the International Space Station talking about this idea of moms in space. We're going to hear a little clip from American astronaut Karen Nyberg talking about what it was like for her family when she spent half a year on the International Space Station when her son was pretty young. And she talks about, you know, how she feels about being a woman in who would go to Mars in this clip.
It was tough. We tried to prepare my husband and I, ourselves and our son, as much as possible. He was 3 when I left, which I think was a good age. I think 8 would be harder. And we would show him the space station when it flew over. Mommy's going to live up there. And he met all my crewmates so that he knew who I was living with. We talked to him about the space station, what it was like. We wanted him to understand as much as a 3-year-old could where mommy was.
And a little bit later in that interview, she talks about, you know, 8 would be harder, meaning, no, she probably would not go now that her son was 8. But, John, you know, moving away from this idea of would it be a man or a woman, probably be a crew of several people, so.
Right, exactly. So it's undoubtedly the reality that the crew that goes to Mars will be composed of women and men.
So how close are we? I mean, that's the basic question.
Well, it seems with all the private commercial industry attacking space, if you will, it may well be not a government agency that at least flies to Mars first, or at least it spurs on the government agencies to say, geez, these private industrial firms are talking about going to Mars. I guess we better get our act together and step it up a little bit. And maybe all this talk about Elon Musk retiring on Mars, maybe that's helping to motivate government space agencies.
Wait, Elon Musk retiring on Mars? I know he wants to bring people there, but he himself wants to retire there?
He wants to retire on Mars. I don't know how legitimate that is, but he says a lot of things that are kind of gets people going and gets people thinking.
Gets the ideas out there.
There's a lot of mixed opinion on Elon Musk because of the things that he's done, but he's done one thing important. He gets people talking about exploring space, both men and women.
Well, and let's play a little bit from Mr. Musk. Here he is talking about what the launch of his Falcon Heavy rocket means for the future. And, you know, in this clip we're going to hear, he basically says what you said, John, that let's just get this whole thing going.
I think it's going to encourage other companies and countries to say, hey, if SpaceX, which is a commercial company, can do this, and nobody paid for Falcon Heavy, it was paid for with internal funds, they could do it too. So I think it's going to encourage other countries and companies to raise their sights and say, hey, we can do bigger and better, which is great. We want a new space race.
A new space race. Again, Elon Musk talking about Falcon Heavy, what the launch of that means. And, you know, Mal, old school space race meant the U.S. and the USSR, right? Going back a couple years. Now it's different.
Absolutely.
A lot more actors.
And it seems like the private sector is doing a faster development job and actually in some cases more accurate job. NASA has the government bureaucracy that it has to go through all the way along the line, which delays things. NASA itself is looking to go to Mars with a personed mission. Nicole?
Piloted.
But sometime it's still aiming for the 2030s, as far as I can figure out. Elon Musk and others, he wants to be able to send at least cargo to Mars by 2022 and people by 2024.
So cargo, even if there's nobody there to sign to say,
right.
Yeah, I got this.
Right. But he's also has to.
Sorry,
that was good. That was good.
That would be really cool, actually.
Right? But I have this Amazon delivery.
You get a signature back from somebody
right.
on Mars. We got your stuff. It's okay.
There's a little stamp on it, right? But anyway, to do that, he has to develop an even larger Falcon rocket. And there's one, they call it the BFR or the Big Falcon rocket. And he's still developing that right now. And he's hoping to have an inaugural launch by 2013 is what he wanted to, as far as the regular heavy one goes. Of course, he didn't get to do that until just last month.
Well, Mr. Musk said recently, I know my deadlines or my
He said, sometimes my timelines are a little, you know.
You know, off by a decade.
Yeah, you know.
Well, and I wonder if Mr. Musk wanting to retire there, if he's heard you, John, talk about the fact that at any point in time, the atmosphere could just be sort of ripped off by solar radiation.
But it's being ripped off slowly.
Okay. So here's, speaking of the dangers, we got an email from Don, and thank you, Don. Don says, as future missions look to travel back to the moon or even to Mars, new research from the University of New Hampshire's Space Science Center cautions that the exposure to radiation is much higher than previously thought and could have serious implications on both astronauts and satellite technology. And, you know, we should talk about this, Nicole. Radiation is very bad for human beings.
Yes, very bad. And it's one of a number of issues that we need to investigate more closely before we actually start sending humans out on these longer missions. So radiation, meaning damage from high energy particles or from high energy types of light called gamma rays, can do nasty things to your cells. I'm not a biologist. I will trip over the biology badly.
Sure.
But it can do nasty things to your cells, to your DNA, causing cancer and disease and all kinds of awful things. Even a slightly higher, but, you know, not immediately deadly level of radiation over a long period of time can cause significant illness and distress. And this is one of many, like I said, many issues that we still have to work at. There's a fabulous book that came out a couple of years ago called Packing for Mars by Mary Roach that goes through a lot of those issues, you know, everything from radiation to psychological issues of sending a bunch of people on a long-term mission in close quarters. So there's a lot of human factors that go into this mission. It's going to be a lot harder than just sending a robot.
Well, that's a great title, Packing for Mars.
It's a great book,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and go ahead, Mel.
Just to add to what you said, Nicole, it also the psychological side that you brought up is that when we went to the moon, it was not too bad to be off the Earth and be on the moon because the moon is always facing the Earth and you have home looking
at
you.
You can see it.
But when you go to Mars takes about 2 Earth years, about 26 months basically, to do one orbit, where Earth goes around twice in that period of time. And so if you go to Mars and you have to spend about at least an Earth year there, because Earth is going to disappear from sight. And they think that's going to have a massive psychological effect on the crew. That's now we're alone. Not that you can't communicate, but still they're not sure exactly how that's going to affect the astronauts and not being able to see home in that dot.
Well, right. Not only they have to be people of great physical stamina, but psychological right. stamina. I think a while back we talked on this program, there was some speculation about the best astronaut team for a Mars mission would be a middle-aged married couple, too old to have kids, presumably already worked out all their disagreements so they could stand to be together in a spacecraft for 9 months. Do you remember that story?
Oh, that'll work out
ago.
Well. That's sure. I remember what I said when you brought that up. I said, yeah, can you imagine that? A married couple?
Anyway.
You need to send a couple's counselor with them.
There you go.
That's the important
You
part.
Didn't put the trash out.
I can't open the door.
Well, moving on from Mars for now, because there's a lot more to talk about. But I want to invite listeners again. You can join us with your questions on this or on the Europa story we talked about earlier. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. So from Mars to way, way beyond our solar system, let's talk about TESS. This stands for the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. Mal, you first. Who is TESS?
Who is TESS?
What is TESS?
Well,
would be a better question.
Yeah, well, basically, it's the upgrade, I guess, to Kepler, because Kepler, as John certainly knows, is the spacecraft that was aimed at one particular spot in the sky at like 100,000. Was it 100,000?
155,000.
155,000 stars simultaneously. And it just found all of these, what we call exoplanets, that there are planets we've discovered after Kepler are very common. Probably about every star you see in the sky more than likely has at least one planet going around it. So we're loaded with planets out there. But, of course, we want to find an Earth-like planet. TESS is going to take this one step further, and when it's out in space, it's going to be able to look at, like, I think it's 40% of the actual total sky and look at even more than that 100,000. It's like,
so it's got a much bigger view, so to speak.
It's going to survey 80% of the sky.
Yeah. 80%? Wow. Yeah, 80%. Oh, okay. I was wrong on that.
Yeah. So it's going to look at a much wider field of view and study those planets that have tight orbits like the Earth's orbit around the sun.
Go ahead, Nicole.
Oh, what's cool about that compared to Kepler? So Kepler, it has to do with taking into account observational biases when you look at things. Kepler stared at one particular spot in space to pick up the dimmest possible stars that had exoplanets that we could detect. Whereas TESS is going to look all sky, but not as dim. So it's catching all of the bright stars, which means it's a different kind of a different sample population, but it also means it'll be easier to follow up with ground-based telescopes, which has been one of the backlogs for Kepler.
That's really important because TESS can only look at a piece of sky for 27 days. And if you're looking for Earth-like planets around sun-like stars that take a year to orbit their star,
27 days isn't enough to see more than one transit. So that opens the door for ground-based observatories, even small ones.
So that exosolar planet count that you always give us, John, the number of planets that we're discovering outside our solar system, that's going to go up, pardon the pun, astronomically, right?
Yes, it is. It's at 3771 right now, and mainly due to Kepler.
Well, once this gets up and running. So let's hear a little bit of an explanation of just the magnitude of information that this will bring. Here's a little bit from Jennifer Burt. She's an MIT fellow on expectations for the TESS mission.
The thing that we're really excited about with TESS is the way that it'll actually build on the momentum that we started with Kepler. So TESS is going to take that same search approach, but apply it to the vast majority of the sky, which still hasn't really been looked at in detail when searching for exoplanets. And by focusing especially on planets that orbit bright nearby stars, TESS allows us to start looking at things like planet composition and atmospheric makeup. And that'll then be crucial when we want to start looking around stars that are even further away and in deeper parts of the galaxy as well.
Again, that's Jennifer Burt, MIT fellow, working on the TESS mission with NASA. And Mal, you made a model of TESS that you brought in. Is that correct?
Yeah, I found it online.
It's adorable.
We've been through this before. I guess we did this with Juno a while back. I brought one in. But one of my hobbies is finding these paper craft models of spacecraft. And my wife says it's getting a little cluttered around the house. But
I'll give you $19 million for that paper model.
Okay. It won't fly as far, though. But it's a fun little thing to do. And those who like to do crafts and things, we took a picture of it when we came in before the show. And I assume it's going online somewhere, hopefully with a link to where I found this model. So if
you want to make one with your kids or on your own. Yeah. Well, it's lovely, and it does give you a sense of what this looks like. And we've got a picture of it on our web post if people want to look at it.
The model is 1/40th of the actual size of the real spacecraft.
Okay,
to give you an idea of how big or small the spacecraft itself is.
So TESS is pretty small then.
Yeah.
And it's going to get all this data on exosolar planets.
Right.
Cool places, John, where we can go and live, right, when we get tired of life on Earth. Well, scientists are very excited about TRAPPIST-1e. One of them said it could be a biosphere.
Yeah, I don't know. I like planets that are orbiting in the habitable zone around their star, and that's the distance from a particular star where if a planet was orbiting at that distance, liquid water could, and I say could, exist on that planet. Doesn't mean there's life. It doesn't even mean there's water. But if there was water, some of the TRAPPIST planets are in the habitable zone of the TRAPPIST-1 star. And TRAPPIST-1e has been found to have an iron core. And the Earth has an iron core. But I think they're a little bit jumping the gun, at least just yet. We don't know if there's any life there. But as we mentioned before, a magnetic field, which partially comes from a metallic core, iron core planet, gives you a magnetic field that shields you from the solar wind from your star, which is important.
Well, coming up, we will talk a little bit more about that because there's a lot of excitement around it, even though you're kind of raining on my parade there, John. That's okay. I was excited to go to TRAPPIST-1e, but that's okay.
I'm excited, too.
That's okay.
We shouldn't be looking for little green ladies on TRAPPIST-1e.
Well, coming up, too, we're going to talk about dark matter. Got a couple emails here, too, from our listeners asking some great questions. You can send us an email as well, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. And if you want to see Mal Cameron's model of TESS, we're going to put it on our web post. You should check it out. There's also a link to the instructions in case on a rainy day you want to make your own model of TESS. We'll talk more in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow, a special broadcast, our on-the-road show to Laconia, looking at historic preservation as an economic driver. Be sure to join us for that special broadcast tomorrow morning at 9 and again at 7 p.m. This hour, our astronomy crew is here, and there has been a lot to cover, including exosolar planets, icy plumes of water on Jupiter's moon Europa, and all the exploration that's going on under the surface and around the surface of Mars. Let's get your questions and comments in for our astronomy crew, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, the email, exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email from Bill in Concord who says, I am fascinated by the exploration of Jupiter and space exploration in general. I can understand exploring Mars, Bill says, as it is technically feasible to land a person there and maybe even colonize it. But with regards to Europa, Bill says, it is unlikely we will ever land a person there. What benefit would there be to gathering data on the plumes of Europa? John, you want to grab that one?
Sure. It's a good question, but it's not the only reason we explore Mars so we can go live there, right? Because if we don't clean up our act here, we're just going to make Mars as problematic as the Earth is. So we have to kind of mature as a species before we go off populating another planet. Otherwise, it's only a matter of time before we kind of foul that planet up. But studying Europa, studying Enceladus, a moon of Saturn that has some of the same kind of characteristics that Europa does, is the quest to search for microbial life. And that is the big question that scientists of all disciplines have been trying to answer. Is the rising of life on Earth and the evolution of life on Earth unique, or has it happened in other places?
The ancient question: are we alone?
Are we alone?
And that's what it's all about.
And it's unlikely that there are alien ray gun carrying aliens on Europa or any of the moons in the outer solar system. But even if there's the slightest little bitty teensy weensy microbe living in the subsurface ocean on Europa or Enceladus, a small moon orbiting Saturn that's spewing water into the solar system, that would be huge. It would be the biggest discovery the human species has ever made. And it means that life on Earth is not unique. And that's big.
That's a question we have pondered forever and ever. Nicole, do you want to jump in on that too? Thank you for the question, Bill.
Yeah, over a long enough time span, I think actually Jupiter's moons would be a great place to visit. Ganymede, the largest moon of Jupiter, I think largest moon in the solar system, has its own stable magnetic field, which, hey, protects you from radiation from space. So I think
maybe Elon Musk should retire there.
Well, no, I think I'm going to claim it first. Okay. So,
so there are lots of interesting moons of Jupiter and Saturn, it sounds like, Nicole, that would be worth going to, or at least sending a probe to collect and scrape.
Yeah, yeah. But like John was saying, the possibility of finding life, another life form just in this solar system would be huge.
Well, and here's another email that came in from Robin Nashua. He says, Laura had a great comment about if only we could harness the 1 and 13 zeros after it watts of power from Jupiter's tidal action on Europa, which keeps its water liquid. Rob says, keep in mind that the sun delivers 50,000 times that much energy to our planet every day. We have all the clean energy we need. And this reminds me of something that you've talked a lot about, Mal. When people ask, well, space is interesting, but why bother? You've talked about the sort of synergy between the technology developed for space and how that translates down to us here in our daily lives on Earth. For example, solar power. A lot of the probes we've talked about on this show have amazing solar power capabilities.
You know, it's interesting. Yesterday, that you bring that up, because yesterday I was talking with, I was at a conference, and there was a booth by a solar company, and we were talking about the power behind that, and I mentioned to him, he's got this lot of companies that go out, and they will put in your solar installation, and you just pay them a monthly fee for whatever. It makes it easier to get into solar. But that solar technology that's on the roofs of houses is far different than the technology that NASA has access to. I was mentioning to him when the Hubble Space Telescope first went into orbit in 1990, they had these real roll-out floppy-type solar panels on the sides of it. And then a couple of missions into it, when going up to improve the Hubble, which what it was designed to do, they took those solar panels off and put on these very rigid type solar system. I says, how does your solar panel compare to those rigid panels? And put on, I says, Well, how about $100 million different?
I see.
You know, so they have access to the whole technology. And explain, I forgot what type it was, but it was the technique of getting the power. It improved the power, but yet they were smaller than the original panels were.
Well, thanks for those emails, both Rob and Bill. You can send us an email as well, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So I'm going to ask all of you about something that I've never, science, you know, scientists get really excited about it, and I'm not really sure why. So, Nicole, to you first. The Goddard Space Center recently published research on a galaxy with no dark matter, and I've never really understood what dark matter is and why I should care about it. So why don't you enlighten me?
Well, it's okay to not understand what dark matter is because we don't know exactly what dark matter is. Yes. So dark matter is well-named or poorly named because it is something that doesn't interact with light. So far, almost all of the astronomy we've ever done is because we see light coming from or reflecting from all of these different objects. The only new thing from that is gravitational waves, which we talked about a little while ago. Dark matter doesn't do that. It's some type of matter that doesn't give off light, doesn't absorb light. It just doesn't interact with light. But it does have mass, which is totally weird. But it does have mass. It has a gravitational effect. So we can detect its presence through its gravitational effect. And so the evidence has been mounting for dark matter for decades, including dark matter in our galaxy, dark matter in other galaxies, and all around the universe. Basically, wherever we look, we see the presence of dark matter. It, in fact, dominates the mass of
galaxies.
See in
quotes.
Yeah,
we
so,
can't
good
see
point.
It.
See in air quotes. Or detect or notice the presence of. Now, what was weird about this galaxy, this was a very, very faint, diffuse galaxy. And what they can do, one way you can detect the presence of dark matter is to look at the speed of stars as they orbit in a galaxy. And that speed is determined by how much mass is inside that star's orbit. So you can look at how much stuff is giving off light and can say, okay, there's this much mass that's giving off light, and then say, well, there's this much mass according to the speeds of the stars, and see if those match. In every other galaxy we've looked at, that doesn't match. There's a lot more matter there, dark matter. In this galaxy, they're reporting that they were able to account for all of the mass with the matter that was giving off light, which would say that it had almost no dark matter in it. What's I find interesting. A colleague asked me about this, and I was in the middle of grading and didn't have a whole lot of time to look at it. But I'm like, oh, that was really interesting. But then I noticed on Twitter, unfortunately, I don't have a link. I don't remember who said it, but several astronomers on Twitter use Twitter as an actual place to have academic discussions and have some questions about this study, about how accurate it is.
Oh, so maybe all the excitement about finding this no dark matter galaxy, they're questioning
whether
that's even accurate.
Like most new discoveries, you've got to follow this up with more observations.
Well, in the mid to late 1970s, a female astronomer, Vera Rubin, who has since passed away, discovered this exact phenomena that Nicole's discussing. Stars move around galaxies, not just our galaxy, but other galaxies, much too fast to be explained by the amount of mass that we can see. So she was the first one to find observational evidence of this stuff that is exerting a gravitational pull that we can't see. That's why they call it dark matter. But Vera Rubin's work in the 70s is really valuable, and this galaxy that appears not to have much is either an exception to that rule, and if that's true, we want to find out why. But maybe you kind of got to look at the exception and say, well, let's recheck our data again.
Well, I want to move from something that I don't really understand and I can't see it to something I understand very well. Large rocks hurtling through space, Mal, coming uncomfortably close to the Earth. There's been some asteroid activity in the neighborhood recently. What's been going on?
Absolutely. It's almost like we have the close pass of the month going on now. last month, we had on April 15th, there was an asteroid called 2018 GE3 I don't know how they name those things. But anyway, it buzzed past the Earth on April 15th, which is a salute to the IRS, probably. But it came about 120,000 miles to the Earth.
Which is pretty close, right, in space terms.
Yeah, that's pretty good. And that's closer than another one that's buzzing us today. So here we are a month later and getting another one. The first one last month, they estimate that it was about the size of a football field, and it was traveling over 66,000 miles an hour as it zoomed past us. But that's, you know, the moon is about 240,000 miles away. And so here's this infiltrator coming about half that distance away. And then today there's another one coming. And I don't know, John, you're going to go out and track this?
No, it's best viewed by its observers in the Southern Hemisphere.
Oh, Southern Hemisphere.
So you can see, okay. People can see these.
Well,
big
no, this is very,
by.
Very faint. You have to have right. a big telescope with an astronomical imaging camera to get even a little tick mark on
I
your
see.
Picture. But this one, 2010, WC9, because this body was discovered in 2010, but astronomers didn't get enough observations of it to calculate an accurate orbit. So they lost track of it until last month. And so on the 15th, which is today, it's going to come within half the distance to the moon of this object that is believed to be between 71 and 130 meters across. And it's traveling at 13 kilometers per second, which is really moving.
That sounds a little bit terrifying.
Well, it's
hope it stays on course.
Yeah, there's no chance of it colliding, and we need to find these big asteroids before we see that they're on a collision course with Earth, because that's the whole point of surveying the inner solar system, to find as many of these asteroids bigger than 100 meters across. That can come within 5 million miles of the Earth, to find them, catalog them, calculate their orbits. So if we do find one that is destined to impact, we have enough time to plan and prepare and hopefully keep that from happening.
Well, and get out of the way. yeah, go ahead, Nicole.
So if you want to be unterrified a little bit, just for scale. So the one in April whizzed by just as I was talking about implants in my planetary science class, and so we had a whole discussion about this, and then we went over the actual distance scales of things in the solar system. So the moon sounds really close because you look up and there's the moon. Hey, it's moon. But if you were to make a scale model of that, so I pulled this off my friend Phil Plait's webpage, Bad Astronomy. If the Earth is a basketball, the moon is a tennis ball 24 feet away. So give that, you know, a sense of scale. That's how far away that is, size and distance-wise. And this asteroid would be, what, like a not even a pebble rolling by, you know, 12 feet away from this basketball. So if that helps, hopefully, space is big, and we have that on our side.
Yeah. Well, from the asteroid to people who want to go up in space and maybe get a better look at the asteroids that happen to be whizzing by. Companies, we talked earlier about private companies sending rockets up into space, doing exploration, but some companies are gearing up for space tourism and betting that very wealthy people will be willing to drop some serious bucks for the chance to stay in space. Aurora is the company. It's going to build a space hotel, 2 weeks, live like an astronaut for a mere $9.5 million.
John, we should do that one.
Actually, the three of us are looking for sponsors. That's
right.
At a cheap $28.5 million. We could go and spend 12 days at this Aurora space station that's going to be taking guests in 2024.
$9.5 million.
I would still be paying off my student loans.
So you won't be going, Nicole. And then I heard. But
now,
wait,
a massive subject here, and we can all do our next astronomy show, including Laura can come and join us, and we can do the next astronomy show from that.
No. I heard the food is going to be really good.
No, I'm a little bit claustrophobic, so the idea of being in a spacecraft
Laura,
for a long
5,600 square feet. That's big.
Well, that's and it gets even more luxurious if you go with the Russians. Okay, so they have also the Russian Space Agency announced recently that they have the opportunity to rent a luxury suite on the International Space Station for, ready, $40 million a week.
A week?
$40 million a week. So I think this space tourism thing is getting serious. And in all seriousness, John, who's going to do this?
Well, so it's going to be the real rich, fabulously filthy rich people that might, you know, go to the Aurora station. But that's going to make more people want to do it. That eventually, in 10 years, the cost is going to become dramatically lower. Not you know, $300 lower, but as space tourism becomes safer and more people do it, the price will come down because it's a huge untapped industry and people want to go to space. I'd love to go to a space hotel for a few days, and I pay a lot of money to do it. But
not
unfortunately,
$9.5 million.
It's not going to happen in my lifetime. But maybe my kids or their kids would be able to take a vacation in a space station and get a look at the Earth that I've only dreamed about getting.
Mm. Well, last quick question for you, and anybody can jump in on the night sky. The weather's good. You can go out. You can see things finally instead of freezing out there. What are you seeing, Nicole, in the night sky that
Jupiter
makes you happy?
Jupiter. Yeah. So taught planetary science this past semester. I got a couple of our students out to actually look at Venus at the beginning of the night and Jupiter at the end of the night as it was rising. Jupiter is a great target for binoculars and small telescopes because you can see the clouds on it as well as
that's cool.
four of its moons orbiting around it. So it's a super cool sight.
I did not know that. Mal, what are you looking at?
I'm waiting for the summer triangle to rise, which is earlier in the evening. And I look at the constellation of Cygnus because the head of Cygnus as my two favorite stars. It's a double star system called Alberio. And there are two different colors. And it's really fascinating to look at.
John, super short. What you looking at?
I'm looking at the same thing Nicole was. I'm looking at Jupiter in the east at sunset and Venus in the west at sunset. But later in the evening, Mars and Saturn are now going to be visible too. So we're going to have a sky full of planets.
Well, and with that inspirational view in mind, we're going to close out the show with some music courtesy of NASA. This is the music that accompanies NASA's explainer video about the exoplanet hunter TESS. So we'll close out on that. Thanks everybody for being here. It was really nice to talk to you.
Great to be here.
Great to be here.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.